Next time, if there was a next time, she wouldn't be so neglectful of her history lessons.
I would not cut this tree down if the king himself commanded me to do so.
Abram looked up the tree trunk again, the crinkles beneath his eyes deepening with a smile. They left the pine behind, circling around tiny spruces waiting in the shade for their chance to grow tall. The afternoon sun waned, forest shadows shifted as they walked. Abram stopped, his head stooped, listening. Blows could be heard, not the crisp rat-a-tat of a woodpecker, rather the chopping of an axe against wood.
We are near the boundary, Abram said. But that still sounds too close.
Without further comment, he bounded away, agile as any deer despite his bulk. Kerrigan watched after him for a shocked moment before urging the horse to follow behind at a trot. Abram hadn't been boasting when he said his long legs could match the pace of any horse. Two men hammered at a tree with broad axes. They had already felled one tree. Two oxen stood by, chewing cud, a sledge chained to their harness to drag away timber. The two men didn't hear Abram and Kerrigan approach, so engrossed by their chore were they.
Stop!
Abram bellowed. Kerrigan would not have been surprised if the whole of Sacaridia stilled at his command. The very trees shivered. The two men paused in mid-strike, terror flashing across their faces when they took in Abram.
You are on King's land!
Abram fisted his hands on his hips. Sun glinted off the blade of his axe. The two glanced at each other and raised their axes defensively.
King never cuts here, one said, and he spat. He can't protect this forest forever.
The second man spoke more uncertainly.
Soon the demand for paper. You are breaking King's law!
Abram broke in without hesitation, his voice strong and sure.
Poaching the king's trees or wild beasts is punishable by death. I am commissioned to mete out the king's justice where this forest is concerned.
The first man glowered, but the second quailed. Kerrigan glanced at Abram in horror. His face was unreadable. Surely he wouldn't... Abram stepped forward, and the first man raised his axe, this time offensively. Abram rushed him and grabbed the handle before the axe could cut him, breaking the haft over his knee. The second man dropped his axe voluntarily.
Kerrigan,
Abram said heavily,
this is where we must part. North isn't far.
What are you going to...
Farewell, Green Rider.
He nodded his head in dismissal.
It was a good meeting.
Abram's look told her that she had better move on. Goodbye, she said. Thank you. But he had already turned back to the two men and did not hear. Kerrigan caught the first man watching her with a dark scowl as she rode away. Surely Abram wouldn't carry out the death penalty. It wasn't in his nature to do so. But the two tree poachers didn't know it. The trees simply ended. Kerrigan and the horse were swathed in full sunlight for the first time since their strange journey together had begun. The horse snorted and sidestepped, and Kerrigan covered her eyes until they adjusted to the light. She let out a low whistle. As far as the eye could stretch, the land was a desert of tree stumps. Only on the most distant hills and behind her could she find trees. They skirted the edge of the woods until they met the road. Kerrigan cast a cautious eye before stepping onto it. The road was a muddy gutter of cloven hoofprints and was rutted with gullies full of water, where timber sledges had grooved the surface. They cantered as much to escape the devastation of the forest as to reach the town of North by sunset. The absence of trees exposed them to watching eyes and left Kerrigan feeling very vulnerable. As dusk deepened, a horseman approached at a quick trot. Kerrigan slowed the horse to a jog and patted the hilt of her saber to ensure it still hung at her side. It wasn't easy to distinguish the horseman from the shadows. He was garbed in a long gray cloak with the hood thrown over his face. A quiver of arrows was strapped to his back, and a longbow crossed his shoulder. His stallion was a tall gray, at least as tall as the horse, but more finely proportioned. The silver of his tack jingled as he trotted. The horse clung to the right side of the road and laid his ears back. "What is it?" Kerrigan asked, tightening her grip on the hilt of her sword. The horse shook his head, his ears flickered back and forth. Kerrigan licked her lips nervously as the gray-cloaked figure drew closer. It would not do to look frightened. The more confident she appeared, the less likely she would be attacked if the horseman was a brigand. She released the hilt of her sword, fingers trembling, and turned to the horseman. "Good evening," she said. The rider turned his hood toward her, its depths vacant of all but shadows. An inexplicable dread weighed her down as the hidden gaze raked across her, holding her for some interminable time, perhaps seconds. She sensed something fair that had been tainted, something of age, but young, something terrible. The horseman nodded, and the gray stallion trotted on by. Kerrigan sagged in relief, releasing the breath she had held during the momentary exchange. The jingle of tack and plod of hooves paused, as if the rider had stopped to gaze after her. She glanced over her shoulder, but no one was there. Kerrigan wilted in her saddle. There was no place for the horseman to hide, yet he was gone. "Don't tell me I'm beginning to see other ghosts," she murmured. But the cold dread returned when she remembered Freean Kobolbay's last words. "Beware the Shadow Man." Sunset blooded the sky behind them as she clucked the horse into a canter, more eager than ever to reach civilization. They did not slow until they entered town, and her initial relief turned into misgiving as she took in the shamble of clapboard wooden structures with garish hand-painted signs advertising mercantiles, a smithy, inns, and pubs. The pubs and inns were already brightly lit from within, and bodies were pressed up against the windows. Bawdy music and loud laughter drifted into the sultry dark. She passed the prancing lady, the broken tree, the twisted mule, and at the full moon, a man staggered into the street with a woman riding piggyback. Her face was gaudily painted. She wore a corset and little else, and was covering the man's eyes with her hands.
"Ha ha, Wilmy," he said, wobbling this way and that down the street. "He let me see now, you hear? He let me, and we'll have good fun."
They disappeared down an alley. The woman's giggles echoed back out to the street, were followed by silence, then delighted squeals. After a time, Kerrigan caught up to, and followed behind, a horse cart. Something large and heavy bumped onto its wooden bottom as the wheels jolted over ruts in the street.
"Hey, girl,"
said a man who leaned against a hitching post.
"What you find?"
The cart driver hauled on the reins and woed his horse to a halt.
"Remember that greenie that come by the other day, asking all those questions about some girl? I found her over by Millet's Pond. 2 arrows in her." "Just as well,"
the hitching post man said.
"We've no need for those types round here."
Kerrigan went cold. Another dead green rider? With 2 arrows in her? She rode by the cart, the horse's head lowered, as if he knew a dead green rider lay in it. Kerrigan didn't want to look, but could not avoid the glint of light from a nearby inn on the rider's gold hair. She lay half on her side, one gauntleted hand stretched out, the fingers slightly curled. The other hand lay across her stomach. She looked as if she might be asleep, except for the 2 black arrows protruding from her chest. The drinking song issuing from the inn made a grotesque dirge. Kerrigan urged the horse on, and the rider's gold-winged horse brooch shimmered in the corner of her eye. Shaken, she stared straight ahead, the conversation and laughter of the 2 men fading behind her. Didn't they care that a woman lay dead next to them? Didn't they know that green riders were brave and deserved more than being thrown into the back of some dirty horse cart? A somber mood took Kerrigan. She dismounted in front of the fallen tree, the inn Abram had recommended. The carved sign above the door showed an axe embedded in a tree stump. No mistake about what this town was known for. A stable boy came to claim the horse. "Is there room for the night?" she asked.
"Yep."
"Then I'll see to my horse myself." The boy shrugged. It wasn't what guests usually requested, but she didn't want to chance anyone seeing her gear close up. She led the horse through an alley to the rear of the inn, where a stable and small paddock stood lighted by lanterns. Kerrigan hitched the horse to a railing and untacked him there. Once free, he trotted to the center of the paddock for an enthusiastic roll in the mud. Kerrigan chuckled despite herself. The stable boy watched the horse grunt and rub his neck and sighed into the ground.
"Where'd you find the horse?"
he asked.
"Huh?" "I saw his scars. A green rider was asking after such a horse the other day."
Kerrigan had to bite her tongue to regain her composure. The green rider had been looking for the horse? "Are you implying I stole a horse, boy?"
"Why?"
The boy looked at her with big eyes. "I bought that horse from a mercenary, at a fair price, too." Kerrigan used as stern a voice as possible, and it was working. She blessed her fast thinking. A mercenary's horse would be prone to scars, too.
"Sorry, ma'am,"
the boy said. Kerrigan smiled. Now the boy addressed her with the proper tone of respect and eyed the saber girded at her side with trepidation. "He thought I was some runaway," she thought, then remembered that she was. "I don't want any slack on his grain. Give him a good rub down and make sure there isn't a fleck of dust on him come morning." She fished for a coin in her pocket. Her father always insisted on tipping stable boys. He claimed they were always underpaid. It hurt to part with a copper. A night at the inn would drain her resources as it was, but she needed to put the stable boy's mind on something other than scarred horses and green riders. The boy received the coin enthusiastically and reassured her that her horse would be well cared for. Kerrigan caught up her gear, the bridle slung over her shoulder and the saddle over an arm, and entered the inn from a side door. She was struck by the aroma of broiled meat and fresh baked bread. Her mouth watered over a table of cooling pies and a cauldron of stew with chunks of beef, potatoes, and parsnips simmering over a hearth fire. She hadn't eaten a true meal since Seven Chimneys. Servants dashed in and out of the kitchen through a swinging door, balancing platters heaped with or depleted of food.
"Out, out, out!"
An imposing rotund woman brandished her ladle at Kerrigan. "I won't put up with horse leather in my kitchen!" Kerrigan rushed through the door, narrowly dodging a servant with a tray of empty tankards. She stepped away from the doorway to avoid further collisions. The common room was clean and quiet, a good sign. Only a handful of tables were occupied. A woman sat by the stone fireplace reading fortune cards for a burly man, and an equally burly woman. They guffawed at whatever predictions the fortune teller had told them. A single musician tuned his lute in a corner. It was hardly what she expected to find in North, after what she had seen already.
"Do you have a request, lady?"
The musician gazed at her intently. She had seen the same expression on Estrel's face often enough, and knew that minstrels missed very little. No, not right now." The man, perhaps middle-aged, bowed his head gracefully and turned his attention back to his lute. For a warm-up, he plucked a quiet song. A skinny man with thinning red hair approached her. His fine vest and coat suggested he was either a merchant or an innkeeper. For some reason, Kerrigan always expected innkeepers to be a bit more rotund.
"You wish a room?"
he asked. "Yes, a single." He raised his brow appraisingly at her, trying to ascertain, she was sure, her ability to pay for a single room. His expression was doubtful, but he turned on his heel.
"This way,"
he said. He led her up a narrow stairway to the second floor. The room he showed her was only slightly larger than the closet she had lived in at Selium, but it looked clean and comfortable. The mattress was feather rather than straw, and was covered with a thick quilt. An oil lamp, not lard or a candle, stood on a table next to the bed. She began to wonder what the expense of a night's stay was going to add up to, and if she was going to end up in the scullery washing dishes, or in the stable mucking stalls. Better that than spending the night in one of those other raffish inns.
"The price," the innkeeper said, "is 4 silvers.
He held his palm out expectantly. Kerrigan's mouth dropped open. Outrageous. Ordinarily, such an establishment would charge 2 silvers, and even that was considered somewhat steep. The innkeeper still stood there, hand outstretched, his expression growing more suspicious. Kerrigan pursed her lips and dug into her pocket. She dropped the precious silvers into the man's hand. He bowed. "This is robbery." She hooked a lank strand of hair behind her ear. "Even the finest inns in Corsa don't charge this much."
"This is North," the innkeeper said. "The extra expense covers security. You may have dinner when you are ready."
He glanced down his nose at her saber and sniffed.
"Arms are generally left in the guest rooms."
Kerrigan self-consciously hitched the slipping sword belt into its proper place. The innkeeper removed a key from a ring on his belt.
"If you are concerned about your valuables, you may use this."
It was obvious he thought she didn't possess much in the way of valuables. "You'd treat me just fine if you knew I was the heir of the wealthy clan Glathian, wouldn't you?" "Thank you." She wanted the key, took it, and shut the door in the innkeeper's face. She would go down to the common room for dinner in a moment, but first she was due for a cleaning in the washbowl. She splashed water on her face and contemplated the day's events. First, the tree poachers in Abram's woods, then the strange horseman, followed by another dead rider in a cart. Garl, the cart driver, had said she was asking about some girl. The stable boy mentioned that a green rider had asked after a horse. Why did the rider search for a girl instead of free in Cobble Bay? Kerrigan's head jolted up. Water dripped from her face and splashed into the washbowl. She couldn't have been looking for me, could she? How would anyone know to look for her in connection to the horse? That is, if she was the girl the rider had been referring to. Kerrigan blotted her face dry with the linen towel lying next to the bowl. No matter what the answer, she still had a message to deliver. And with the death of another green rider, it appeared she must be more cautious than ever. She unwound the bandages from her wrists. The burns were healing surprisingly well, though there would be some scarring. It seemed ages since her encounter with the creature of Canmer and Vane. Would anyone believe her when she told that story? The burns could have come from anywhere, even a campfire, as Torn had once suggested. She gazed in a mirror to assess her appearance. The bruises on her face had faded some, but were still visible. There wasn't anything she could do about that. The winged horse insignia was still hidden on her rolled sleeve. She unbuckled her sword belt and left it with the rest of her gear. There was nothing about her that suggested she was connected to the Green Riders. Satisfied with her appearance, she locked the room behind her and trotted down the stairs to put some food into her empty stomach. A few more patrons occupied the common room. Some were dressed well enough to be merchants. Others were in either dusty traveling clothes or the plain garb of the locals. The minstrel strummed a cheerful tune about how a chicken changed the fortune of a farmer. It was a simple tune, perfectly suited for an inn. Kerrigan felt the minstrel's eyes follow her as she walked across the room to a small, empty table. She dropped into a chair, only to discover that the table was an enormous tree stump coated with varnish. The number of growth rings convinced her that this tree was older than the tall white pine Abram had shown her.
"You wantin' some food, missy?"
Startled, Kerrigan looked up at an aproned servant.
"Yes, anything that's hot."
"Thought so. You look like you haven't seen real food in a while. Drink?"
"Wine, if you have it."
"Old Ram Canoro makes blueberry wine, which we sell. It's a bit rough at first, but good enough when you get used to it."
"That's fine."
The servant disappeared, and Kerrigan settled into her chair to listen to the minstrel. Her eyes roamed the room. Most patrons were in deep discussion. A few played board games. The fortune teller was alone now and stared back at her unabashed. She was dressed garishly in red and blue, with colored glass beads dangling from her neck. Rings flashed on her fingers as she absently shuffled fortune cards. Without preamble, she left her table and walked over to Kerrigan's. She sat without greeting or permission and adjusted her skirts about her legs, the beads of her necklaces clinking together. Kerrigan shifted uncomfortably in her chair.
Something I can do for you?
I am Clathius, seer.
The woman spoke with an intensity that suggested many held contempt for her title.
Perhaps I can do something for you.
Sorry, I don't want my fortune told.
Ordinarily, she wouldn't have minded, but she didn't possess the coin for something so frivolous.
I won't read your fortune. These cards merely mirror one's thoughts.
Clathius spread them across the table. Colorful pictures of kings, queens, knights, merchants, seafarers, and courtiers gazed back up at Kerrigan. Clathius swept them back into a deck, nimbly shuffling them as she spoke.
The cards can read nothing. They simply reflect.
Her eyes, deep brown, focused on Kerrigan's.
I'm more interested in the ghost that shadows you.
Kerrigan half stood, her chair scraping the floor. When she noticed other patrons watching, she reddened and slid back into her seat. The patrons turned their attention back to their games and conversations.
You see?
I see a young man in green, too young to die, yet two arrows pierce his back. You know of him? He struggles to speak to you and to me. He's speaking now, but we cannot hear. He hasn't the power now.
Why do you tell me this?
Why should I not? You are more than you seem, though you try to conceal it. The ghost is warning you of something. If you know what it is, perhaps you can avoid it. If not...
Clathius shrugged.
Here you go, missy.
The servant slid a bowl full of steaming stew, a platter of sliced beef and mushrooms, bread and a goblet of wine in front of Kerrigan.
Now don't distract the girl from her victuals, Clathius.
The servant left humming to herself. Clathius scowled after her. Kerrigan broke off a piece of warm, moist bread and offered it to the seer. She waved it off, her necklaces jangling. Without another word, Kerrigan shoveled succulent stew into her mouth, sucking in air when it burned her tongue. Her stomach growled voraciously, and the seer watched her take every bite. More tables filled up, and the noise level of the common room elevated as the minstrel played foot-stomping, hand-clapping, jig-dancing, boisterous music. When Kerrigan had eaten her fill, she sank in her chair with a hand on her gorged belly. More than half the food still remained on the table, but her stomach, which had grown accustomed to so little food, would accept no more. She sipped lazily at the wine. At first, it was a bit sour, but after a while, she was convinced of its fruity flavor. Clathius shuffled her cards and leaned toward Kerrigan, so she couldn't be overheard by others.
I find it interesting that a green rider should be searching for one who matches your description.
Kerrigan sat up, all attention now.
My description?
There are some who know seers can be helpful. They will listen to seers and believe.
Clathius frowned.
I saw only that rider's disaster when I looked at the cards.
She's dead.
I warned her something terrible was going to happen. You know of her, then?
I saw her body.
Clathius clucked.
I didn't learn her name, but she sought a girl and a horse. You wouldn't know what it means, would you?
You're the seer, Kerrigan said.
You don't know, either. Curious. A ghost follows you. You conceal who you are, and a green rider searching for someone of your description dies.
She cut the deck in half and turned over a card. The picture was a rider in green on a red steed, fleeing arrows. Kerrigan's eyes widened. She had seen fortune cards before, but never this one.
How?
Clathius's brown eyes were fervent.
Were I you, Green Rider, who was not, I wouldn't linger in North. Heed the warning of the card, for it is the same one I saw when I read for that dead rider.
King haters. Kerrigan sat immobilized, and it was some moments before she realized Clathius had left her to wander among other tables to offer the telling of fortunes. More people trickled into the inn. A group sat in a tight cluster at an adjacent table. Among them was a petite Titian hair woman. When she spoke, her eyes afire, all others leaned in closer to listen. Kerrigan strained to hear too.
Tomorrow,
the woman said with the clipped roving accent,
we shall hold the rally. The people will hear us and support us. It is the people who shall rule, not a man who thinks himself one among the gods.
There was a murmur of agreement.
From North to Sacker City,
one man said above the others. The woman smiled, dimples deepening on either side of her mouth, and Kerrigan saw how people could be magnetically drawn to her. She hushed the group.
And then the Lone Forest? We will go to the Lone Forest and answer to none but ourselves.
A babble of approval circulated among the group.
Pie, missy?
Kerrigan jumped, startled out of her observations, and wrenched her attention away from the group to the servant.
I don't think so.
She smiled with regret, for the pies had looked mouth-watering.
But maybe you could tell me who that woman at the next table is. You're thinking about joining their group?
I don't know what their group is. The servant pushed a wisp of hair from her eyes.
Why, they're the Anti-Monarchy Society.
She glanced over at them, then said in a whisper,
there's some that call them the King Haters. Their ideas are a trifle far-fetched, but they say things folks want to hear. That's Lorelei, their leader. Rumor has it that she was roving aristocracy until King Thurgood cast her out of the country for her beliefs. Ever since, she's been a thorn in Zachary's side. Surprises me that the Greenie wasn't looking for her the other day. Lorelei Duran's considered an outlaw in Saccharidia, but seeing as most everyone else in North is an outlaw, it doesn't much matter. I'm surprised you haven't heard of her.
I haven't heard the news of late. It's been a long while since I've traveled through a town of any size.
I guessed. Your ribs must be bare bones beneath that shirt. Oh, well, most aren't sure what to make of Lorelei, but they can't dispute her ideas.
She collected the remains of Kerrigan's dinner and ambled away toward the kitchen. Kerrigan glanced over at the Anti-Monarchy Society. They talked among themselves in excited voices, while Lorelei Duran watched on, somehow separate and above her companions. Then she turned as if feeling Kerrigan's gaze on her, and smiled. With a word or two to her companions, she sauntered over.
Are you interested in our group, sister?
She asked. I don't know what you're about, except that you don't like kings. Lorelei pointed to the chair Clathius had occupied earlier.
You mind?
Kerrigan shook her head, and Lorelei sat down.
We are more than what some call us. King haters,
she made a wry face.
Our desire is to uplift the common folk who presently slave beneath the oppressive forces of the aristocracy.
I'm all for showing the aristocracy a thing or two, Kerrigan said, but I don't understand the slave part. Slavery was banned in Saccharidia during the Second Age.
Oh, they won't call it slavery, but that's what it is. Landless folk breaking their backs to fill the pockets of their overlords.
Overlords?
The landowners. The aristocracy. And of course, it's the common folk who pay the bulk of the taxes, while the aristocrats and merchants get fatter.
Wait a minute. Kerrigan sat up a little straighter.
Merchants pay taxes?
Yes, they do. But it's not proportionate with their wealth. They should be taxed more heavily, but they are favored by the king.
Lorelei leaned forward conspiratorially and put her hand on Kerrigan's wrist.
Look, sister, we are all in this together. Only by ousting the king and the aristocracy will we be able to raise the people to their proper level.
Hey, Lorelei,
called one of her friends,
Skella wants to go over tomorrow's speech.
Lorelai nodded.
One moment.
Then again, her intense eyes were on Kerrigan.
Sister, a revolution has begun, and a new order will arise.
She smiled grimly, then joined her followers. She spoke softly to them, and they huddled close to her. Then, after a bout of loud laughter, they left the inn. Kerrigan swallowed the last of her wine. A revolution? A new order? It was too mind-boggling for one who had been on the road so long. Although the dig about merchants annoyed her, and understandably so, everyone had the opportunity to do as her father had, to gain wealth and status through back-breaking work. And would Lorelai Durand punish her father for all his good work, and for supporting commerce in Saccharidia? I don't even want to think about it. I've got enough problems to last 9 lives of a cat. Kerrigan stretched and yawned. The wine and food had made her somnolent, and the sooner to bed, the sooner to rise and leave North behind. As she strode across the common room, the minstrel's eyes followed her without missing a note of the song he sang. She scowled at him, then realized that several of the men in the common room, many lumberjacks by the look of their wool shirts and broad shoulders, followed her with their eyes too. The servant met her at the bottom of the stairs.
Don't concern yourself with these lugs, missy. Innkeeper Wiles keeps order here, though he can't keep the men from looking.
She rolled her eyes knowingly.
This is a respectable inn. If they want the company of a woman, there are plenty of other inns in town where they can find it.
Thanks, Kerrigan said. She wondered how the innkeeper enforced order in such a rough town, but was glad to hear that he did so one way or the other. Once in her room, she changed into the oversized green rider shirt to wear to bed. She sank into the comfortable feather mattress, anticipating a restful night, but discovered she could only toss and turn. Voices and the clatter of dishware disturbed her some, but it was the events of the day that jostled around in her mind and kept her awake. In the small hours, when the music and chatter in the common room died down, sleep began to take her. But she suddenly jolted awake, quivering. The hairs on her arms stood on end, and her heart beat wildly, but she didn't know what had roused her. Then, there it was, faint, barely perceived footfalls in the corridor outside her room. A worn floorboard creaked. A shadow darkened the crack between the door and floor, then passed over the keyhole. The doorknob twisted one way, then the other. Kerrigan held her breath, stiffened, listening, afraid to move. Her sword was on the other side of the room with the brooch. A sharp light pierced through the keyhole, searching, probing. Kerrigan sat up and threw the covers aside. The cold night spread goose pimples across her body as she swung her legs over the side of the bed. She tiptoed across the icy floor, took up her saber, and waited by the door. Strangely, the door seemed to flex and swim in her eyes. She blinked, but the door still distorted and warped in fluid motions, and she felt with a creeping certainty that it wasn't her own groggy vision that warped the door, but magic. She reached for her brooch unconsciously and discovered it was warm to her touch. The door would give in moments, and with growing apprehension, she knew it was the Shadow Man, the rider in gray, who intended to enter her room. The shaft of light probing through the keyhole suddenly withdrew, but before Kerrigan could breathe a sigh of relief, something else came through. At first, it was so dark and tiny as a fly. She could not see it, but it was even darker than the night, a small black orb that floated on the air, and her eyes fixed on it. The orb bobbed and drifted toward her, expanding as it did so. It was oily black and radiated a halo of darkness that pushed away even the possibility of light. The orb continued to grow. Tendrils of energy flared and arched across its surface, searing and scorching. Kerrigan backed away, but the thing, now the size of her head, moved with her. Kerrigan backed until she was pressed up against the wall and could go no farther, and still it moved toward her. Then,
heavy footsteps clumped outside.
"Who's there?"
a man asked. The door hardened into ordinary solid pine wood again. The orb halted, wavered uncertainly, then shrank in the blink of an eye, and whisked out through the keyhole. Feet padded lightly away, and Kerrigan closed her eyes in relief. Moments later, someone tapped on her door. Holding the saber level before her, she opened the door carefully. To her surprise, the minstrel stood there, his lute in one hand and a glowing oil lamp in the other.
"May I come in?"
he whispered. His face looked gaunt in the flickering light.
"If the innkeeper or his guard Taran find me here, I shall be skinned where I stand."
"Why should I allow you into my room?" Kerrigan demanded none too quietly. The minstrel peered about nervously.
"You are wise in your caution, considering someone was trying to break into your room just now. I think I frightened him off. A stealthy fellow. You've nothing to fear from me. I am but a minstrel and carry nothing in the way of arms. My lute would be a clumsy weapon against your blade."
"Some minstrels are trained in the fighting art."
"True, especially if they were trained in Selium as I was. But I never took up a sword."
"Selium?"
"Yes. I believe that is where you've come from, too."
Kerrigan's mouth gaped open. She stepped aside for the minstrel to enter. She shut the door behind him, but didn't sheath her sword. The minstrel glanced around the room as if something might leap out of the shadows at any moment.
"I am Gawain, a master of my craft. I would have sought you out sooner, but if I didn't perform as usual, someone might have gotten suspicious."
What a master minstrel might be doing in a wilderness town like North, he didn't say. Without hesitation, he sat on her bed. It was the only place to sit. "What do you want?" Kerrigan asked. "How do you know I've traveled from Selium?"
"A green rider was looking for you the other day. At least, you answer her description. When she saw I was Selium trained..."
He pointed to the gold master's knot on his shoulder.
"She knew she could trust me, and she knew that a master minstrel wouldn't have been placed here by mistake."
Kerrigan would have liked to have known what he meant by that. "I know a green rider was looking for me, or somebody who looked like me."
"You missed her by about a day."
"She's dead. I saw her body in a horse cart." Gawain shook his head, bewildered.
"I never thought the townsfolk would go so far as to actually kill someone from the king. Joy hadn't been a rider long."
Kerrigan sat cross-legged on the floor and rested her chin on her hands. "I'm not sure it was the townsfolk who killed her." Gawain cocked his head, his eyes searching hers. Minstrels certainly possessed penetrating eyes.
"What is it you know?"
"All I know is that others, including another green rider, were murdered in the same manner. 2 black arrows with red fletching."
"Strange. Strange things are brewing. Poor Joy was searching for you, or your twin, but you weren't her primary concern. A messenger horse was."
"She didn't say why on either count, did she?"
"It was too much of a coincidence." "No, but young lady, of greater concern are the others who were looking for one who also matched your description. Their description wasn't as detailed as Joy's, but good enough to make a match."
Kerrigan bit her bottom lip. She didn't want to ask, but she did anyway. "Were they Merwellian?"
"I see you know you're being pursued. They were here a few days ago. I'm not sure where they went after North, but they were in a hurry. I thought nothing of it till Joy described you. She didn't tell me, though, that you were a green rider."
"I'm not." The minstrel blinked, his only hint of surprise.
"You wear rider insignia."
Kerrigan had forgotten about the winged horse embroidered on her sleeve. "I'm delivering a message for a dead green rider," she said.
"Killed by 2 black arrows."
She nodded.
"My dear young woman, you should not linger in this town. These black arrows sound like an omen to me, an omen of the dark past. No doubt it has something to do with Mournhaven the Black."
Kerrigan shuddered. Whether it was the cold of the evening or the name that caused her to do so, she wasn't sure. Mournhaven the Black's name had come up a lot since she had started this strange journey, even though he had been vanquished centuries ago.
That person outside your door may not have been an ordinary brigand either, Gawain said.
How so? Kerrigan's voice held little surprise.
Most don't dare tamper with the guests of this inn. Keeper Wiles' man, Terran, hasn't stopped short of killing to retain order here. Whoever wished to gain entry does not fear him.
Goose pimples broke out all over again. Did you get a look at him?
Gawain shook his head. He was light of foot and disappeared into the shadows the moment he detected me. The corner of his cloak caught in my lamplight. It was grey.
A knock on the door startled them both.
Oh no, the innkeeper and his guard.
Gawain rolled his eyes. Kerrigan climbed to her feet, carefully draping a blanket over her shoulders to conceal the rider insignia before she opened the door. The innkeeper stood in the corridor, flanked by a hulking giant who was, if not as tall as Abram, at least as wide. He held an enormous club in his hand, and nothing about him suggested Abram's mild and careful nature. Now she knew how the innkeeper enforced order.
"Is everything well here?"
the innkeeper asked. The corners of his mouth turned down as if to imply he didn't really care, but he had a reputation to maintain.
"Everything is fine," Kerrigan said. "Gawain and I were just having a conversation."
The innkeeper sniffed and cast Gawain a severe glance.
"You know the rules, minstrel. No associations with the guests."
The guard thumped his club into his hand in emphasis.
"You do your job well, but if you can't abide by the rules, I shall have to release you."
Kerrigan watched in fascination as Gawain affected a convincing facade of humility bordering on fear.
"It's really nothing, Keeper Wiles, really."
His eyes were downcast and he bowed.
"The lady and I were just making conversation. We hail from the same town. It won't happen again, I assure you, sir."
"It's truly all right," Kerrigan said. "He's done no harm." Wiles grunted in disdain.
"You may keep your job. For now."
He turned down the corridor, his guard following behind with heavy footsteps. Gawain dropped all facade.
"That man is a pompous... well, you saw him. Mind what I told you, young lady. And mind whatever Clathius told you, too. She's an accurate seer. Farewell, and good luck to you."
Kerrigan stood alone in her dark room. The door creaked as she closed it. She turned the key in the lock and fell back into bed. Sleep would be impossible now, and she gave some thought to leaving that very moment, but it wouldn't do to arouse any more suspicion than she needed to. Besides, the starless night was less inviting than the warm inn, and she would rather stay put than encounter the Shadow Man again in the dark. Merwell. The Green Rider passed the envelope to Beryl. Beryl glanced at it, front and back, then handed it to the governor. "It bears the king's seal, my lord." Merwell looked the envelope over. It was addressed to Honorable Thomasine II, Lord Governor of Merwell Province, faithful servant of Sacharidia. The seal on the back was Zachary's, but featured his clan emblem, that of a Hillander terrier, pressed into heather-colored wax, rather than the royal emblem of the Firebrand and the Half-Moon. He slit the message open with his dagger and read the contents. Afterward, he handed it back to Beryl to read. The greenie waited, standing statue still with her hands clasped behind her back. Merwell glanced at her, then his aide.
"Rider?"
"Iria Mafarthen, my lord," Beryl provided.
"Rider Mafarthen, would you tell us what else you carry in your message, satchel?"
The messenger's eyes grew wide, and she glanced questioningly at Beryl before her eyes fell back on the governor.
"With all due respect, my lord."
Merwell stayed her words with his hand.
"Please, humor me, Rider. I ask for reasons of personal security."
Beryl nodded to her reassuringly.
"Good."
Sometimes it took another woman to lend support.
"I'm an old bear, ugly enough to make anyone nervous."
The rider cleared her throat.
"With all due respect, my lord, while messages from His Excellency the King are matters of his own business, it's no secret that I carry another invitation to deliver to the Lord Governor of Adeland. Merwell nodded gravely.
Thank you, Ryder Mafarthen. Drang will escort you to the kitchen for provisions to make the rest of your long journey comfortable. In the meantime, I shall craft my reply.
Thank you, my lord. The rider bowed out of the library, followed by a soldier in scarlet. When she was out of earshot and the doors closed, Merwell turned to his aide.
What do you make of it, Spence? Another greenie, trying to reach Zachary's spy?
Beryl pulled thoughtfully at her lower lip. After a few moments, she shook her head. No, my lord.
How can you be so sure?
I believe her intentions are as she says, to deliver invitations for the king's banquet and ball. It's certainly something she did not fabricate. Besides, we haven't found any spy in your household yet, and we've been very thorough. Merwell knew how thorough. Everyone who inhabited his keep, from the lowest servant to the highest courtier, including Prince Hamilton and Beryl, had been interviewed extensively, some to the point of torture. He had delighted in the screams of some of the courtiers he particularly disliked, and admired some of the techniques Beryl had employed to get them to talk. The results, however, indicated that no spy existed within House Merwell. One positive byproduct of the investigation was a reminder to his subjects of his authority. All the better if they trembled a little when he walked by.
My feeling, Beryl said, is that Corbelbay was working on his own.
Merwell tapped the catamount head of his armrest.
Nevertheless, I'm not willing to take chances. Bring me Taggon.
The guardsman was summoned and clicked his boot heels to attention before the Lord Governor.
Taggon, see that Ryder Mafarthen doesn't come in private contact with anyone while she's being provisioned. Get a look in her message satchel if you can. Then, get her underway as soon as my reply to the king is prepared. Escort her out of the village. I expect a report. Do you understand?
Yes, my lord.
When the guardsmen left, Beryl said, I could keep an eye on the rider myself, my lord.
I need you to respond to Zachary for me. Your hand is fairer than mine.
She stepped over to his massive desk, a behemoth of carved cherry wood inlaid with blonde oak, which sat upon legs fashioned as the talons of some enormous raptor. He never used the desk himself, and rarely even cracked a book in his library collection. These had all been acquired over the generations, mostly by a Merwell of more scholarly tendency. Thomasdine II suspected that the province had begun to fail during that particular ancestor's reign. Still, he liked the ambience of the room, with its large fireplace and hide-covered armchairs. Beryl seemed to feel right at home behind the desk. She dipped her quill into the inkwell.
Your message, my lord.
Write to our esteemed king that we will accept his invitation.
We, my lord?
Merwell smiled broadly.
Yes, we. Did you notice the date of the ball? Not long before the king's annual hunt.
That's what concerns me.
What better way to conquer than to be there to see it happen, eh?
Beryl brought the message over for him to sign. He took the paper, and the hand that held it. He caressed her hand. The palm was well calloused from using a sword, but the other side was soft and smooth, not riddled by the brown spots and tangle of green veins women his age were cursed with. She looked at him, stricken.
As I said, you've a fair hand, my dear.
He released it and looked the letter over, ignoring her as she stepped away and clasped her hands behind her back. She stared straight ahead, at nothing.
We shall have a fine time in Sekka City.
Yes, my lord. Her voice was flat.
She took the message, slipped it into an envelope, and sealed it with red wax and the imprint of the two warhammers. She left the library a bit hastily, Merwell thought.
We'll see what comes of a visit to Sekka City.
He stood over his intrigue board. He'd have to find its traveling case. Maybe he would have Drang look for it. He picked up a red governor and a red soldier and placed them in the court of the Green King.
I look forward to the hunt.
Rally. Kerrigan stepped out into the overcast morning, leading the horse down the alley to the main street. The stable boy watched after them wistfully, probably hoping for another copper. He deserved it, Kerrigan reflected. The horse gleamed despite the dullness of the day. She just could not afford to dip into her reserves for more coins, but she had made a point of praising the boy for his fine care. The main street was still muddy. Townsfolk walked on wooden boards lined in front of nearly every building and storefront, but the boards didn't help if one had to cross the street or veer off course. Women held their long skirts high, their faces in perpetual frowns as they trudged through the slop. Kerrigan grimaced herself as her foot sucked in the mud. The shine on the horse's coat would not last long. She mounted to let the horse deal with the mud, and they went in search of a food vendor. Shopkeepers were just opening their doors and throwing back shutters. A blacksmith fired up his forge, and the roar of flame could be heard all the way out into the street. North could have been any town awakening, but this one was without refinement. She missed the cobbled streets of Selium. She found a shop with cluttered shelves of baked and dried goods, coarse cloth, axes, knives, ropes, handsaws, blankets, lamps, flour, sugar, lard. Everything a town of this sort could use. She dismounted and hitched the horse to a post in front of the shop. She scraped mud off her boots on an iron rung placed outside the doorway just for that purpose. As she stepped inside, she heard a shout on the street. She peered through a window and watched a man, encumbered by two sacks, running through the mud, making little progress. He was pursued by another man, whose white shopkeeper's smock was splattered with mud.
Come back with that, you thief!
The shopkeeper, unencumbered, caught up with the other man and jumped on him. The two fell into the muck, each grappling with the other. Passers-by paused to watch the scene. A dagger flashed in the thief's hand, and he struck down at the shopkeeper. The shopkeeper loosed a hollow wail that Kerrigan felt every inch up her spine. The thief had stabbed the shopkeeper, and no one had attempted to stop him. The thief climbed to his feet, threw the two sacks over his shoulder, and walked away. Pedestrians ignored the thief and simply walked around the shopkeeper's body, as if it were no more than a rock obstructing their path. Someone clucked his tongue behind Kerrigan. A burly, bald-pated man in a white smock shook his head, his jowls wobbling.
Old Mile didn't take any precautions.
He patted a short sword sheathed at his side. Anywhere else, a shopkeeper wearing a sword was an unusual sight. Isn't anyone going to do anything? Kerrigan demanded.
Old Gar will be along to pick up his body, the shopkeeper said.
But the thief?
Who's gonna run after him? You?
Kerrigan blushed with shame.
No one wants to risk their hide. I see you are sensible and carry a sword. Not common among a girl, but sensible. What can I do for you this morning?
It took a moment for Kerrigan to shake off her sense of disgust at how easily the shopkeeper slid from murder to commerce. She couldn't think about it. She had to carry out her own mission, and there was no time to dwell on North's problems. She suspected that if she didn't get to Sacker City soon, more people would die. She chose dried meat and fruit, tea, bread and cheese from shelves, and some grain for the horse from a hogshead. She set them on the counter in front of the shopkeeper.
2 silvers, he said.
Why, that's robbery, she wanted to say. She held her tongue, the price raising bile in the back of her throat. But she was, after all, a merchant's daughter, and not without bargaining skills. 1/2 silver, she said. The shopkeeper smiled in appreciation. He was a bargainer, too, and looked so smug that few probably got the better of him.
2 silvers is how it stands.
Kerrigan furrowed her brows together. 1/2 silver is all these goods are worth. But I'll raise it to 1 silver. I can see it is difficult to earn a living in a town such as this. The shopkeeper nodded.
A fine offer, but a man needs more to make a living. A silver and a half, plus a copper.
Kerrigan shifted her stance. The man didn't give in easily. She wondered how many people were taken by bargainers such as him. When she lowered the price to one silver, the shopkeeper scratched his bald head, as if not sure how it had happened. One silver is still ridiculous for these goods, but I'll accept the price. She passed the precious coin across the counter. As she did so, something gold glittered in a basket of trinkets on display on the far end of the counter. How much for the brooch? She asked. The shopkeeper brightened.
Why, one silver. Not so much for such a fine piece.
He placed the winged horse brooch in the palm of his hand for her to look at. A deplorable price, Kerrigan said. A cheap trinket. One copper is generous. She knew full well that the brooch was just as much pure gold as her own, but chances were that the shopkeeper saw it as a gaudy piece of costume jewelry, as had Torn and Jindara seen hers. The shopkeeper raised his brows.
That ring you're wearing, a clan ring?
Kerrigan had forgotten about her mother's troth ring. It probably wasn't something she should wear openly, with its gold and diamond in a town such as North. She sensed, however, that the shopkeeper was suddenly intimidated. Rarely did she ever use the traditional clan bow, but she did so now. She placed her hand on her heart and dipped low. Clan Gladian, at your service.
Merchant clan?
Yes.
I should have known. I wondered how you managed to out-bargain me.
He chuckled good-naturedly.
Copper it is, for the brooch.
Kerrigan couldn't believe her good fortune. She thought she would end up having to pay at least half a silver. She pushed the copper across the counter and took the brooch. It was heavy and cold in her hand. All of the blood hadn't been polished off. The folk here were no better than Torn and Jindara, picking valuables off the dead. She dropped the brooch into her pocket, collected her goods, and left just as a bewhiskered man dressed in buckskin strode in, beaver, fox, and mink pelts swaying over his shoulder. The body of the shopkeeper had been removed. Farther down the street, a crowd assembled. Most folk were garbed in the colorless textiles or buckskin of the town. A few merchant types added a splash of color. Kerrigan loaded the saddlebags with her newly purchased goods and mounted the horse. The sooner they left town, the better. They plodded carefully toward the assembly. Members of the Anti-Monarchy Society formed a barrier around Lorelei Duran, who stood atop an overturned apple crate, addressing the crowd. Not everyone likes Lorelei's ideas, Kerrigan thought idly, or they just don't like Lorelei.
You say the king protects you?
Lorelei demanded. A man shifted uncomfortably in the crowd.
That's right.
The crowd jeered him. He was well-dressed, perhaps a merchant, and definitely not local. Lorelei held her hands up to quiet the crowd.
I suppose the king does protect and favor the wealthy. The wealthy can afford it. Your merchant's guild is as bad as the governor's council, trying to control entire villages with your trade and your rules. But what of the folk here in North?
Lorelei's eyes seared those of her audience.
A man was killed this morning in the street. No one was here to prevent the crime. The king didn't protect him. The king won't fund a constable to keep order in this town. He will fund constables to guard the warehouses of rich merchants in Corsa.
Her hands flew as she spoke.
The only time we see a representative of the king is at tax time.
A low grumble circulated among the gathered. Kerrigan tried to guide the horse around the fringes of the crowd without drawing attention to herself. But people blocked the entire street and were too transfixed by Lorelei to move out of the way. Lorelei drew herself to her full height, which was not considerable but seemed impressive nonetheless.
Will raising taxes on lumber products protect the folk of North or other small villages like it? No, it will cast more beggars into the street. More families will go hungry. Despair, my sisters and brothers, will consume them.
The king uses the taxes to fortify the country,
the merchant shouted.
I call that protection. What with all the ground mites lurking about